All right, today is February 16, 2005. I am Catherine McKay, and I am in the library at Weber State University, and I'm here with Eric Jacobson. This is part of the project to capture the history of technology at this university. And let me ask you, Eric Jacobson, if you will, in fact, tell me when and where you were born to start us off with some biographical information.
I was born in Marshalltown, Iowa in 1944.
Education, particularly higher education?
I got a bachelor's degree from Grinnell College in Iowa and a PhD from the University of California in Santa Barbara.
Oh, great place to be. What took you to California? What took you to California for that degree?
I wanted to study with a researcher in the psych department there.
So your degree is, in fact, in psychology?
It is.
Did you start out in a field of psychology after your degree? What were you working in after you got the PhD?
I had a postdoctoral position at the University of Pittsburgh working at a research institute that did research in school learning. And my particular part of that was mathematics learning in primary school, mostly using computer technology to assist in that learning.
Is that what you focused your dissertation studies on?
It was not. I was in a standard old field in psychology called learning and motivation, and my research had been entirely done with rats before that.
And then you moved into studying people, specifically how they learn math. But tell me the connection between math learning and computer technology. How were you connecting the two?
Well, that was what some people think of as the golden age of computer use in instruction. National Science Foundation and other government agencies were supporting a lot of research. This is from about 1965 to 1975 in how the new computer technology could assist in learning. And there were major grants to several important institutions, and the Learning Research and Development Center where I was had such a grant, and I was working off that grant. We got several other grants while I was there. And the idea was this wonderful new computer ought to be useful in supporting, managing, learning, and let's find out how.
Did you say this was at Carnegie Mellon, or where was the...
University of Pittsburgh.
University of Pittsburgh. And how long were you in this postdoc project?
Well...
Or program, I should say.
Pardon me, I don't remember the details. I started out
right.
As a postdoc, and then I took on a research position, research faculty position at the university. And I can't tell you when one ended and the other one started.
Yeah, because it was all part and parcel of this kind of research that you were doing.
That's right.
What kind of products were you producing? Were you giving reports, making presentations? What were you learning from your research? How was it being made public?
We developed computer-assisted instruction and computer-managed instruction tools, which were used primarily in our research school, which was in a suburb of Pittsburgh, but also in a couple of the inner-city schools. And we introduced these to the kids in experimental settings such that we could identify what was working and what wasn't working. And then the results of that research were disseminated in tech reports from the center, journal articles, and a lot of presentations at various kinds of meetings.
Obviously, it does a disservice to ask you to sort of condense this in a very few words when you've written papers and produced it. But essentially, what is it that you were finding out about whether or not computer-assisted learning was working?
Well, the very simple first approximation to our results was that the computer didn't add much to a well-designed, well-run school. And that I've looked at the literature since and thought about it, and there has been further research since, and I think to go a little bit beyond that, the idea that a computer could be useful in assisting learning was based on some assumptions about human learning which are probably not true in general. There's a major exception to that. There's one area in which computers can be useful in a somewhat limited and very focused kind of way. But basically, we've tried the things that seemed obvious, use the technology in ways in which other people were using it, and it didn't make much difference. One study that I did, which I still keep coming back to because it really illustrated what was going on to me, is we had a module to teach multiplication algorithms to fourth graders. We developed this on the computer and gave it to fourth graders, and their learning rates, the time it took to learn this material was reduced by a factor of four. Our computer kids learned it in about a quarter of the time as the regular instructor kids. We then just printed out all the material that came from the computer and gave them to kids on paper and let them go through it at their own pace using paper with no computer. And these kids just did just as well as the computer kids. When you develop instruction for a computer, you have to think it through, consider all the contingencies, and since the computer is going to make no judgments, you have to make them all ahead of time so that in a sense, the computer's software is more prepared than any human instructor normally is. If you put that time into preparation and think it through and make sure that your instructional materials are complete in that sense, then you've got good instruction and you don't need it. A lot of the positive results that come from computer experiences come because of the great amount of thinking that had to go into preparing that instruction in the first place.
This is so intriguing because I know in my own experience in trying to develop an online class that the biggest failing is my own not fully telling the machine what I wanted to do. In other words, and I in my face-to-face classes, of course, I could constantly correct myself and rethink and everything else. But the machinery forces me to think much more deliberately because it is, after all, a machine. So I do appreciate this issue of preparation and thinking things through, planning. I'm also intrigued that what it seems to me is being confirmed in the research you did, and that is that learning really is about human interaction. Learning is as much a social activity as it is anything else, that human beings give encouragement, give support, react to each other.
Actually, that you can't find that in the research.
Oh, you can't? Okay.
The particular study I'm talking about, the alternative instruction to the computer was all on paper and students at home.
Okay. So it was really about the planning.
That's one of the assumptions about human learning that is, I find it very difficult to get people away from, and that is that humans learn from feedback from the environment. Humans, that's not an important aspect of human learning. We experience things and we organize those experiences and we fit them into our knowledge of the world, and we don't need feedback. Pigeons, to get a pigeon to peck a key, you have to provide feedback. Basic learning paradigms that come out of the animal laboratory have been too easily generalized. I can read a book and I learn a lot, and that book doesn't talk back to me at all. and specific research has been done looking at the effect of feedback and how quickly feedback has to come. Turns out it's not important anymore.
I was thinking in terms of two models. One is the apprenticeship model, which of course is an old model of learning in human experience. And it's both experiential, but it's also where you have someone who is offering suggestions. And where you see that model continuing to operate is usually in the performing arts. That's how we learn to play the piano, or we learn to act.
Plumbing, or
carpentry. Yeah, exactly, where it's very experiential. That seems to be a very old and a continuing model in human learning. I'm one of those learners that does learn by reading books, but there is a human being that wrote the book. I'm not getting the book becomes the text somewhere in between what I bring to the reading and what the author has put on the page. But I still think about the human being that has created the text, and perhaps that's a bigger stretch, but you and I, and it sounds like a lot of us, are still people who learn by reading or by that individual confrontation with a text or a piece of film or something else. Even though the research suggests that most of our students don't learn that way, that they learn much better, more experientially, that very few of us, and we're the college professors, we're the ones that teach other, but we tend to be the learners that are quite independent or self-sufficient, and that doesn't seem to be the majority of our students.
Well, to say experiential does not, though, say that learning depends on feedback from the environment.
Okay.
And that's a different orthogonal statement altogether.
Okay.
There is an ancient study out of the animal lab where one of the standard paradigms is to make a rat hungry and put them in a maze, and there's food somewhere in the maze, and they learn how to make the right returns to get the food, and they get very good at going through the maze in the most direct path to get the food. If you put well-fed rats into the maze and let them wander around for a while, they don't go directly anywhere. They just wander around. But then, if you make them hungry, they go straight to the food. They've learned the maze, and they've just learned it from experience. They just didn't have a reason to go any one particular place or another until you give them a reason to go, then they do it. Mm-hmm. So, experiential learning, reading from a book, all of that is a matter of the organism attending to certain things, saving that in memory, and then that information is available later if the environment calls.
How'd you get to Weber State?
Well, I had a couple of faculty positions in a couple of other institutions after I left Pitt, and my research got more and more into developing computer stuff for the laboratory and for statistical analysis. I got more and more interested in computers, and I was looking around and thinking, Weber State was looking for a coordinator for academic computing, and I applied, and the institution wanted me, and I decided I wanted it, and so I came.
What year?
1982. You need to talk to somebody who was here before 82, because as I reconstructed, 82 was a landmark year in technology at Weber, and major changes were made. Including the development of the position I took. Before that, there had been nobody in that company. And a decision was made to have a staff member.
Do you have a recommendation for somebody that we should talk to?
Who's left? Bob Smith, who was academic vice president at the time, must have been involved in that. In fact, it was probably his final decision, because all of that reported to him. There was another vice president who was involved in those issues. He was still in town, but he retired back to Jerry Story. Roy Stock was in the computer center and would have known some, at least some of them, what was going on. The faculty, if you haven't done this already, you need to talk to Bob Capner.
Okay, good.
He was here then. And I'm not sure who else would have been involved, because I wasn't here when that decision was made. As near as I reconstructed, sometime that year, or maybe the year before, they sacked the director of the computer center for reasons I don't really know. Decided that there'd been one big major computer on campus, and everybody shared it. They decided at that time to separate administrative computing use from academic computing use and have two separate sets of machines. They decided to buy a new academic computer and went through the rigmarole and figured out what that would be, and a lot of time working on these. So within about a six-week period, a new director of the computer center came on, a new big new computer came on, and I came on. And I think everything must have changed.
How would you define academic computing? What constitutes academic computing? I mean, I assume that part of it is the faculty work itself, so that faculty is using WordPerfect. I mean, faculty might be doing some initial research. Of course, that has expanded exponentially. But do you think it was also about
what
instruction? Well, I try.
Was it Louis the 16th or Louis the 14th? Academic computing, c'est moi.
Uh-huh.
No, literally. The first position for academic computing, at first the university thought there ought to be something called academic computing, was when they hired me, and I was coordinator of academic computing. When I retired, the Department of Academic Computing disappeared. So I was there when it was born, and I was there when it died, and I was in the middle of it all the way through. It is a very, in terms of the basic structures of the university, it's a strange and even phony kind of entity. It's very arbitrary, especially at Weber, which is so fractionated. The academic thrust and load is in the separate departments and in the separate colleges, and there is almost no shared academic facility. The library is an exception, and it's been able to maintain itself, although it has been kind of dicey during the period I've been here. Probably because historically universities have had me, and libraries are an important part. And the way it's organized, you know, the director of the library gets to ED and gets to find out on that level. No other shared academic facility exists, and it's very difficult for one to survive. I think we did pretty well to keep academic computing going for 20 years, but you have to wonder whether it is a good idea. Students and faculty think of themselves as members of a department, and only secondarily do they think of themselves as at Weber State. And so getting a chemist to work with a mathematician, to work with somebody in the College of Education on a shared project, it goes against the grain. And no matter how much goodwill there is on all sides, it doesn't seem natural. But it worked for a while because the introduction of technology was new, and the resources were so limited, people could share information in fruitful ways, so they did it, and they could share projects to get more funding and resources in a way in which individuals or departments would not be very successful. And during that period, there was a large amount of building people could work together pretty well because of this shared perception of a shared need. I think it's kind of withered away because people are pretty much have what they want now.
You must have studied models at other universities and colleges. Since you've characterized the situation at Weber State in terms of very departmentally oriented loyalties or identities, you must have looked at academic computing at other institutions. Is there another model out there that you are aware of that you looked at? You spent 20 years of your life essentially creating, defining, and promoting something that was called academic computing. And if it lived and died with you, I want you to talk about the legacy in a minute, but I also want you to express if, because I know you well enough to know that in trying to strategize this, in trying to make this work, you must have studied other institutions. Did you see parallel struggles? Did you see the same struggles? Did you see different solutions?
I guess this is sort of embarrassing. I didn't study other places as much as you might think.
I've
been at several institutions. Yeah. I had just come from a school that was well set for academic computing. And I went to conferences and I talked to people. I never confronted any sort of plan that I thought this is it. This can guide our decisions. There were, you know, good ideas here and a good idea there, but nothing that was comprehensive. And I didn't try real hard because what little I saw didn't seem to help. But another aspect of that was, you know, something that I noticed when I first came at Weber is a kind of inferiority complex. And I resisted that. That a lot of people felt, well, let's go to the University of Utah and see how they do it, as if they had any better idea. And mostly, especially with the University of Utah, they were behind us, and may still be at this point. And I thought it was important to get homegrown solutions and get people thinking about the problems and thinking what will work for us, mm-hmm. rather than import a model that worked at Oregon State.
Let me ask you then to describe the job and the place from which you came. Where did you come? Where were you when you were hired?
Well, I went back to Grinnell, and I was on the faculty at Grinnell, which is a much different kind of place. One-tenth as many students then. Fewer than that now. It's about 1,000. Residential, liberal arts. There's no allied health, no business, no technology. None of the applied fields here. In fact, when I got there, they were just reinstituting the certification program for teachers. They had dropped. So none of the applied areas, not education, not technology, not business, not... and the other striking characteristic, of course, is that it has lots of money. And when I came here, it was like being 5 or 10 years behind in terms of technology. And that was just a funding issue. But Computer Center... See, back then, most of the technology was based on a very small number, maybe one, large computer that everybody shared. And at Grinnell, we had gotten grants just in the last 3 years before I left to equip our labs with microcomputers. We had Apples and our stuff, but that was just the leading edge of it. Just began. So in that kind of centralized atmosphere, running it, doing computer work involves managing this big computer. And since it's centralized, there's this tendency to have the staff centralized and everybody together. So there was a computer center at Weaver, just like there was a computer center at Grinnell, just like there was a computer center at Weaver when I came here. And this is one of the interesting differences. The staff, there were four programmers available to help people at Grinnell. Three helped faculty do academic work, and one did the administrative work. When I came here, there were zero programmers doing academic work and 10 to 12 doing administrative work. And that has never really greatly changed. As technical staff have been added at Weaver in IT, there's very little programming done anymore compared to what it used to happen. So it's IT staff that helps bring up and tune software packages you get from outside, which is probably good. I mean, when everybody programs their own, there's a lot of inefficiencies there. But those people now work for departments. They are not in a central facility. And I'm getting a little off the topic here, but that also might be good because those people can be closer to what really needs to be done.
The frustration I have as a faculty, and you and I have talked about this a little bit previously, is that I don't find much incentive or much support for sort of rich conversations between faculty and technical people, I mean, for want of better language, about issues of learning. That's where I think we have not done as good a job, which goes back to, of course, your original research. I mean, how can we use this technology to help our students learn? What kinds of questions should we be asking about learning and technology? And I don't think faculty have rich conversations about learning anyway. But I don't think we have rich conversations about the relationship of learning and technology. I don't know how you do that here, but I know you have at least been involved in some efforts to create those conversations, when it was faculty study groups or teaching learning forum initiatives. Are those questions that we should be asking at the institution, perhaps?
Yes. Although I would broaden that in a major way, but I came here, I can't remember how this happened. I don't think I instigated it. I think somebody saw the need already. But we very quickly formed a faculty computer committee. Used small letters on that, small F, small C. I can't remember the exact name, and it's been instantiated under several names during that period. But it was the way in which I could work with faculty and they could communicate to me, and it was the place of sharing across departments. And we wrote several reports. We looked at all the needs and possibilities and considered priorities, and we wrote several reports over the years about where we thought things ought to be going. It was a fascinating intellectual exercise for me, and social. There's a lot of horse trading and a lot of disagreements about what priorities ought to be, a lot of which were not resolved, but at least I got to see where they were, and I got to try to thread our way through all of these, and it was a lot of fun. It was hectic and nerve-wracking, but I'm not sure it helped much. I don't know, in terms of getting people to talk about things and consider what the priorities ought to be and come together, maybe that helped in a kind of deep, fundamental way. It didn't have a lot of direct impact on what the institution did, at least for a while. The most recent form of that committee has been a standing committee of the Faculty Senate, and that's been there for a long time. And in some years, depending on who's in it, it is a way in which these discussions take place. But I was on the other side. I was I was an administrator in technology, and I don't know who there is now. You can get the faculty together, there's ARCC still exists, but right. I'm not sure who on the other side who's makes decisions. You have to talk to them. And I repeat, I think, this is going to sound very self-serving, but I think this university is way overloaded in terms of administrative support for the money and the efforts are for helping people in the administration building get their job done. Very little resource goes into helping faculty get what they need. And I'm not so sure. I think maybe the faculty have given up. They're not demanding as they used to be. In about 1992, we did compare resources spent at Weber State versus that set of system institutions that was doing it. Our average was 10% of what the average was. Our expenditures were 10% of what the average was in other institutions. Small warning there, it's a little hard to figure out exactly what you're using because they're different budgets. Near as we can tell.
Do you think it made a difference that you had an academic degree and you have a PhD in psychology, that you actually had taught and had some experience as both a researcher, so you had a faculty, in other words, you could talk the talk of faculty in ways that I don't know that persons in the technology support can talk that talk.
You'll have to talk to the faculty I worked with
okay.
for them to make that decision. I don't know whether it helped them.
Yeah, I would say so.
But I wouldn't have been interested in the job. What was really fun is all that research and all those ideas were really neat, and I liked to get involved. We had things going in chemistry and art and history, you know, projects that, from which people published papers. He did research. Paul joined the music, built an ear trainer system on a Cumber machine, and we tested that. There was some neat projects out there, and I'm an academician, and I like those academic projects. For me, it's what made it helpful. I don't think computers are going to help them. I think in most of the fields in which our students are studying, computer technology is used as a professional tool in some very interesting ways, and they need to be using it as a professional tool. It's not that it will help them learn something that's separate from computing. It's the content, it's the subject matter, it's not the means to the end, it's the end itself. I think that in the social sciences, there's some wonderful statistical tools, and I'm not sure whether this university has those tools and is teaching them in ways that they ought to use, for example. And I think that's, at least when I left the computing area, that seemed to me as the greatest use, to get our students doing the professional work with computer technology and learning how to. And see, that's not using the computer to help them learn.
I wonder if we were to create richer partnerships with community resources, if that would be. I think some fields do that better than others, both in terms of how difficult it is for the university to constantly, you know, in terms of resources, that they're not well funded to keep up with all of that, but also to give our students some hands-on experience with a hands-on training with using the kinds of tools that you're talking about to do the work. I think we do some of that, but I wonder if that's a direction that we should be.
I don't know. I really can't.
Yeah.
See, there is a danger there, and that is when you're running a business or doing a research lab, there's certain products you've got to get out. And
sure.
And whether somebody learns something from it or not is at best secondary. But university should be more cutting edge. When I talk about statistical techniques, it's not what state historical society would need to get done. It's what can be done, and what are they doing interesting at Stanford in terms of computer searches or whatever. And the kinds of advanced, experimental, try it out kinds of things that somebody who has to meet the bottom line is can't afford. That's our role. That's why the state pays us this money, is to not just do what you can do it out there, but to look at what ought to be done, could be done, or maybe will be done in 15 years.
I wonder why we're not having those conversations. I wonder why we're not thinking that through. I mean, you've raised some issues that I certainly haven't thought about. I don't know.
Neither one of us can speculate
about where the leadership is or where the grassroots bubbling up kinds of things are.
Ellie Sampson and I wrote a paper for CAUSE, which is the major organization for computer use in academic institutions. Describing how the faculty, the ARCC, the faculty committee, worked and how it's spent money. And as part of the research project, you should look at that paper.
Good. No.
But it was bubbling up. I mean, that's what we were seeing. It was the deans, vice presidents were ignoring us, and the ideas were coming from individual faculty that then kind of coalesced in terms of university priorities. The extent of the faculty committee could make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought it was working pretty well, at least for a few years.
It seems that nowadays what I'm seeing in many ways has to do with gadgets, sort of delivery mechanisms. So I just saw an email in my own college that says, well, let's put more gadgets in the classroom. I'm not seeing them talking about new ways to use the technology to accomplish a particular research project or to accomplish, it's whether or not we can show more pictures or whether we can,
That projection equipment might be very valuable, but it is at the level of a new kind of blackboard.
Yeah.
And maybe somebody ought to be putting it in there, but it's not worth a lot of thought.
Exactly. It's certainly not cutting edge. It's not.
No.
If that is in fact the role of the institution, or
people that have been involved in technology have commented on this for at least 40 years. It really is easier to focus in on tangible things. A new computer, the next version, that new projector, and the farther away you get from that thing you can touch and hold, the harder it is to focus interest and get people to think about it.
Exactly. So, what else do you think should be part of this oral history record that you are creating today? What's a question I haven't asked you? Because I didn't know enough to ask you. Okay.
Maybe a way to make
good
a specific way to
good.
We sort of talked about the transit, so I'll maybe be repeating myself. The big change in computer use and academic computer use nationwide, worldwide, was between about 1965 and 1990. And we've been fairly static since, or relatively static. The upward downward slope is a lot less steep. And the institution and individuals are forced to think about, is this a good idea? Where can we get the money? Should we get the money? How are we going to organize support services? And people who went through that period, they worked very hard and learned a lot, and the ones that survived had to have a lot of fun. But and the innovations, the institutional innovations that I've seen occur then, the only new thing since then has been the notion that correspondence courses could be done on a computer. And I have not been involved in that, so I guess I shouldn't speak much of that. But that, the original idea of using computers in education was that people would learn better. And the research is pretty solid and indicates they don't. The idea of web-based learning is something different. It's not that people will learn better, but we can make it more convenient for them. And I just personally wasn't too interested in that, and I'm still not, so I don't have much to say about that. But as it's turned out at Weber, that's been mostly outside of the faculty hands.
Yes.
And so it's not been a faculty academic issue. And again, there hasn't been much happening in faculty academic areas. And that's why people have gone back to their offices and gone back to doing what they've always done. And innovations are not going to come from a machine. They're going to come from people doing the work who decide there's a better way to do or something that we need to do differently. And then they'll go look at ways of doing it. And that has to come from faculty. But we talked about trends. That did happen. Let's look at this computer technology, let's explore ways of using it, let's see what we can make of it, and I think Weber's got some handicaps, but within those handicaps I think it did a pretty good job. But now it isn't doing it anymore, and there's less reason to do it.
Well, and from what you're saying, it's part of a larger, Weber's not the only place where we're sort of at stasis. You're suggesting that the whole arena is at a kind of stasis, or you described it as a less steep innovation. I mean,
and you talk about people interested in gadgets. The people who see fast change and all these new things, they're looking at gadgets.
Yeah.
Yesterday I bought a new PC. It does exactly what PCs did 25 years ago. It does it faster. And I get more colors on the monitor. But it's still communication to the internet, which I was doing 25 years ago. It's word processing. I can do things with pictures, but I could do things with pictures on the big machine back then. The hard technology has changed a lot. And so things are a lot cheaper and a lot faster and more reliable. But it doesn't change my life. It changed my life 25 years ago, but it doesn't anymore.
That's a good comment. Thank you.